My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today, all the way from Minnesota, is Emily Reese. She is the on-air host for Classical Minnesota Public Radio. She is the host of Top Score, the classical NPR podcast about video game composers. She created NPR's Learning to Listen series, another great podcast, by the way, from which to learn about the classical music. And her background is in music education. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here, Daisha.
What are you going to be teaching me about today?
Beethoven 5.
Nice.
Yeah.
That was good. Well, this is exciting. I kind of like can't believe we've never covered this piece. It's like it's the one everybody knows.
Yeah. And you know, I never have either. And so when I told my boss that I was speaking with you today, she's like, they've never done a Beethoven 5 show. And I'm like, Julie, I've never done a Beethoven 5 show. It's like, and this is exactly why we're doing it.
Yeah. It's like this piece that everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
But that they kind of don't know it. It's like,
right.
You know, it's so ubiquitous that nobody actually sees it, you know?
Yep, yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, mm-hmm. I'm excited. Let's do this thing.
Good.
All right, where shall we start?
I mean, what would you like to know about it?
I kind of want to know a little bit about, like, I've from other episodes learned a little bit about Beethoven as mm-hmm. a person, but maybe you can give a little bit of background on who he was, when yeah. he lived, and then, like, at what point in his life did he actually create this piece?
Perfect. This was in what we call Beethoven's middle period, and Beethoven is one of those composers that has a very distinct early, middle, and late period. Some composers, it's a little more difficult to tell when they wrote their music, but Beethoven's style went through such huge changes that it's pretty easy to tell when something was written if you hear Beethoven. Mm-hmm. He was born in, let me think here, was it 1770? Mm-hmm. And he died in 1827. Mm-hmm. So he was in his mid-30s. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony premiered in 1808, and he'd been working on it for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. The other interesting thing about this being his middle period is that he's already going deaf right now. He's, by the time he had written his Third Symphony, there are reports that he was having trouble hearing the clarinets during rehearsal. Oh. And so those were some of the early indicators during his Third Symphony, which was, I think, like 1800 or 1801. So he knew by this point and was already having pretty big difficulties with his hearing, mm-hmm. which is another thing that makes this, in my opinion, just so spectacular. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something we know, but it's like, think about that for a minute. Just think about how he managed to do this. You know, with such limited hearing at the time. He wasn't completely deaf yet, but he was really struggling. So he was mid-30s. That answers your question. Oh, and Vienna. He was in Vienna. He wasn't born in Vienna. Vienna, well, that could be a whole other show. Vienna loved Beethoven, and they did not love Mozart. And so it's really interesting to see how they held Beethoven up as this god. And whereas just, you know, decades earlier, they had really kind of snubbed Mozart. So it's fascinating. He lived at a very, very exciting time. So
what was kind of his creative impetus for writing this piece? Like, what was going on with him when he, I mean, I'm wondering yeah. also, like, maybe the fact that he was going deaf, did that lead to some of the loudness of the piece, the like bombastic nature of it, because
definitely
you can hear it better.
Definitely. And the dynamic markings, too. When we read music, there's all kinds of markings on it, just like a map, that tell you exactly what to do when, mm-hmm. above and beyond what the notes do, right? It's telling you how short or long to play the note, how loud or soft to play the note. And Beethoven really pushed that louder and softer. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, you hear that in this symphony. It goes from very, very quiet in some parts where you're just like yourself with relatively normal hearing straining to hear something. And then, yeah, it does get way loud.
Okay. Well, I know that you kind of mentioned that he was beloved in Vienna. And mm-hmm. just generally speaking, he was very popular. And,
yes.
And you know, he was a celebrity. And
yes.
And so you know, I other than his deafness, I never hear a lot about the struggles in his life. I just hear that he was doing really well. Like, I mean, was there?
Mm-hmm.
But was there anything besides the deafness that was maybe going on with him that brought this piece out of him?
Well, it was around the time of the Third Symphony that he wrote a letter to his brothers, and it's called the Heiligenstadt Testament. And it's basically he wrote a letter to his brothers saying how he had noticed he was losing his hearing. He did not want to live anymore, but he said something to his brothers like, "I have too much art in me to leave this world right now.
Whoa.
I have too much work to do," basically. And I mean, that's amazing to me that he felt that way, that he definitely did not like what was going on. He didn't want to live that way, but he felt artistically he didn't have a choice. And
wow.
That's pretty remarkable.
That is
so
remarkable.
And again, that was a few years before he worked on the Fifth, but he did work on it for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that whole like mid-30s time for him was really tough. For a long time, he tried to hide the fact that he was losing his hearing, which, you know, only works for so long. And then, you know, people talking behind your back and wondering what's going to happen. And I mean, I guess most people think he wasn't always that nice of a guy. He was
right.
Kind of grumpy. And I mean, if I was a 35-year-old composer and I started losing my hearing, I'd be grumpy too. But
mm-hmm.
But yeah, he was a force. I mean, he really just did things his way.
Mm-hmm.
And Symphony No. 5 is a really great example of doing things his way.
We should hear some of the Fifth Symphony since we have yet to have any of the music in the show.
Sounds good.
Where do you want to start at the beginning, or is there a place you want to
start?
Well,
yeah. I mean, we should start at the beginning because it's, you know, the most famous part.
Yeah.
I mean, even during World War II, the BBC used to use that opening motive, that four-note motive.
Mm-hmm.
They used it on the radio because it sounds like what the letter V is in Morse code, and it was V for victory.
Whoa.
So that they used that ba-ba-ba-bum on the radio because apparently that's what V sounds like in Morse code. And what's even cooler is that Beethoven 5, of course, the Roman numeral for 5 is a V. So
Whoa.
That's
mind
all
blown.
Coincidental. You know, that's just all... Yeah.
Haven't people said about it that it is the sound of fate knocking on the door?
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, I think it was one of Beethoven's students or maybe his copyist who said something like that. And Beethoven was just like, come on. I mean, Beethoven just really didn't, you know, he wasn't a namer. He didn't really tend to name his own things. Like Moonlight Sonata, he didn't name it that. And you know, like he, I think he did name the Sixth Symphony, but a lot of times those are added on by publishers. And so I think that one kind of made him roll his eyes a little bit.
I love it.
But I mean, no matter how accurate it is, I mean, it really is kind of an accurate assessment of what those four notes sound like.
Thank you.
Wow. And there's the second theme. That's the start of the second theme.
Todd and I are rocking out in the studio.
It's just so amazing.
It's so good.
Yeah. And you hear those first four notes and you've heard the material for the rest of the first movement and consequently pretty much the rest of the third and fourth movement. So it's just absolutely blows my mind what he did with those four notes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can hear it even under us right now.
Yeah.
Da 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 da. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's all these little sections of four notes just woven in and out of each other, and it's absolutely remarkable. There's also a real sense of like question answer in this symphony, particularly between the strings and winds. At times, they kind of trade off on these little motives, and it's kind of a delightful romp, in my opinion.
Yeah. We should mention, too, what recording we're listening to, because you asked specifically for this one, and I can't remember. Let's see.
Yes. It's John Elliott Gardner. And John Elliott Gardner is the conductor, and the band is the Revolutionary and Romantic Orchestra. And here's the thing about John Elliott Gardner is that he was part of that clique of folks in the 70s and 80s that were really experimenting with early instruments. So they're not using modern violins and stuff. They're using like gut strings and things like that. And the sound is, you know, obviously not exactly like Beethoven would have heard it, but it's as close as we think might have sounded like. And I just think it's amazing. Plus, John Elliott Gardner is just such a fabulous conductor when it comes to detail. And you really hear a lot of these really tiny woodwind lines that Beethoven just kind of dropped in here and there. And it's just a really, really good recording. So
You mentioned gut strings, and we should explain to listeners. Well, I'll let you explain what those are.
Yeah, well, modern string players, like if you go to see your big symphony orchestra, they're going to be playing on steel strings, much like a guitar. So it's like I can't get the terms exactly right, but it's a, you know, twine or whatever it is, wound with steel. But back in the old days, they didn't have that technology, and so they played on gut strings, and not having been a string player myself, I seem to remember it was usually cat gut or maybe sheep gut.
Ew.
That sounds right, too. I know. But boy, does it make a beautiful sound.
It makes a really distinctive sound. I mean, it's just got that, like, it sounds so early music-y. I don't know how else to say
it. Yeah, a little earthier, maybe, is sometimes how I think of it, because but just by nature of how the strings are made, they can sound a little bit more, I think, kind of aggressive at times.
Yeah.
But they're
like really chunky. It's almost like a slap bass sound or something like that.
Yeah.
I noticed that when it first started playing. I also noticed this orchestra and Gardner are interpreting this piece at a faster pace than I've heard it before.
Yes, and this is something famous of John Elliott Gardner as well. If you listen to all nine, he did the whole, all nine of Beethoven's symphonies with the Revolutionary and Romantic Orchestra, and many of the tempi are pretty brisk. And, you know, say what you want about that. People have very strong opinions one way or the other. You know, I have pieces that I prefer to hear much slower than normal, and I have pieces that, you know, I think it's a lot of it is personal taste, but I mean, the energy that comes from this particular recording of Beethoven 5 is an energy you're not going to find on just about any other recording. I mean, there are really great recordings of Beethoven 5 out there, but I'm sorry, this is just one of the best. Just because of that energy and verve.
Yeah, it just starts out like at a sprint. It's like, okay, it's on. It's happening.
Yeah, and they just nail it. I mean, you can just tell they're really into it, and it settles into this groove that, and I just love being able to use that word when I'm talking about a symphony. You know?
Yeah. All right, Emily, let's talk about this second movement.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
The second movement is lovely. I just think it's so beautiful. And this demonstrates, again, I mean, if it's not obvious enough, Beethoven is one of my favorite composers. I love him. And I love his softer side because he gets so much attention for the dark storminess. And then you hear this second movement and it's just so gorgeous. And this, he's like playing right into the hands of the Viennese because it's basically like a theme in variations. It's mm-hmm. actually a double variation. So there are two themes and he varies them both throughout the movement. And that particular type of music was super popular in Vienna at that time. They loved theme and variations. I don't know if they just thought it was really clever or what, but it was the in thing to do. And he did it in this symphony. And it's just so pretty. There's so many, so many little pretty parts in it. So yeah, we can hear some of it if you want. You hear the first two themes pretty much back to back. And here's the second theme coming up in just a minute, winding down the first theme. Yep, that's the militaristic influence that comes in there. And he brings back a little slice of this at the very end of the final mm-hmm. movement, which is pretty neat too. Yeah. You're like, hey, I think I've heard that before. You know, like the first couple times you hear it, you might miss it. But mm-hmm. then you're like, oh, cool. That's from the second movement or whatever. And here the variations start and they're just lovely. I keep saying that word. Oh my God. I'm going to have to like take a shot. And when I listen to this every time I say lovely, but
drinking game.
Yeah. But it's such a good word for it because it's just such pleasant music.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know.
It's nice. We can also, everybody take two shots every time you hear me say interesting.
There you go. There you go.
So, as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, so a theme is like it's a musical idea, like an idea expressed in music, and then the variation is just a sort of take on that.
One way you can think of theme and variations is if you think of a sentence like, I'm going to go eat lunch. Now think of all the different ways you could say that same sentence.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm going to the kitchen to make a sandwich. Or, I mean, they're all variations on the same theme, right?
Yeah.
It's that you're going to eat. So in a lot of ways, that's what happens in a theme and variations. You hear a melody at the beginning, and then that melody gets messed with for the rest of the piece.
Okay.
One of the best examples, or maybe one of the most accessible examples, is Mozart's variations on what we call Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, but uh-huh. he didn't. And so you can hear, because that's a melody that's so familiar to us. Mm-hmm. You know, we grew up singing Twinkle, Twinkle and the ABCs to it, so we know it pretty well. And you can hear how he tinkers with it throughout the rest of the piece. And that's essentially what Beethoven's doing here, except he's doing with two themes. He presents one, he presents you the other, and then he lets them play together for the rest of the movement. And it's beautiful.
Nice. We'll hear a little bit more. okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute, because personally, piece is, it's just, it's badass. But yeah. Is it really great, or is it just catchy? And oh. what's the difference?
Oh, I could get myself in so much trouble right now. let's see. There are composers in the history, I am not going to name names, but there are composers in the history of classical music who are very good at writing beautiful melodies. You know, just making your heart cry from hearing a melody. Mm-hmm. But once the melody part is over, they might struggle with what to do with it a little bit. You know, maybe for someone like me, I went to grad school for music theory, so I'm really into like the nitty gritty and nuts and bolts. So I understand that I have different expectations than a lot of people, and I'm okay with that. But one of the things that I have always admired about Beethoven, and I believe this symphony reflects so well, is his architecture. It's a brick house. The symphony is a brick house that by the time you get to the end, you're reminded of themes from the beginning. And so it creates this cyclic symphony, which nobody had really ever done before.
Yeah.
And so to think about taking this, a performance takes anywhere between 30 and 40 minutes, let's say more like 35 to 40 minutes of Beethoven's Fifth, to be able to round out a piece of that length with such precision, to me, is just like mind-boggling. And and just the fact that he took those four notes and he made those four notes, the essence of the material for the first movement, it's the essence of the material for the third movement, and he brings it all back in the fourth movement, and it even questionably refers to it in the second movement, which is really remarkable. I mean, you eventually get to other composers who did stuff like this. Brahms did it with his Third Symphony, Dvorak 9, Berlioz Symphony Fantastique. These are all cyclic symphonies. But you notice I'm not saying, Mozart or Haydn or anybody before Beethoven. I mean, he changed things with this, and really inspired generations and still does with how to construct a piece of this length.
So this
I hope that wasn't too rambly.
No, not at all. So it was he was an innovator.
Absolutely. And that's what people, they kind of considered, they thought of him like as an inventor back then, because he was taking what was, more appropriately, I would probably consider him a modifier. Because like the thing about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, it really closely, the very first movement, adheres to what we call sonata form. And that's something that Haydn and Mozart utilized constantly. I mean, pretty much every single symphony of Haydn starts with a movement in sonata form. Same with Mozart. And so Beethoven, on the one hand, is saying, look, I can do this too, but this is how I'm going to do it. And it's going to sound nothing like what anybody else has ever done.
So he really moved it forward.
Yeah, and so I guess when you say innovator, that is an appropriate way to think of it. But really, because of the things I think particularly he did with piano, they considered him more of an inventor, really, which is kind of fascinating. And of course, the third movement of Beethoven's Fifth is not a minuet. And in Haydn and Mozart's time, that's exactly what it would have been almost every time without fail. It would have been a minuet and a trio. Uh-huh. And Beethoven threw that out. He was like, God, I'm so sick of minuets and trios. He's like, I can just imagine him sitting there thinking, if I have to write another freaking minuet, I'm just going to close the piano lid on my head and say goodbye to the world. Because, it was just like nonstop. But he just decided, nope. And so for the third movement in this symphony, he took something that's kind of like a waltz, only made it a lot faster and more fun, basically.
We should hear it.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the third movement.
Yeah. So many things to say about this movement, too. Now, just imagine that slower. And there are plenty of recordings of it slower.
Yeah.
But I mean, the aggression of those horns coming in, it's just like, yeah, do it. I love it.
Well,
this bass thing that's coming up in just a moment, we've got to hear when the double basses come in, which is absolutely insane. Nobody had ever written for a double bass like that. You know, it's like, that what he asks them to do is insanity, because they have these giant instruments and they're just like doing all these super fast runs and stuff, and it's like kind of like a fugue. I don't know if you've ever talked about a fugue on your show, but yeah, here it comes.
What?
So that's just, I know, that's just crazy. And so you see how he kind of stacks it on there? That would be, we'd call that fugal. It's not technically a fugue, but it's referencing that Baroque form. So we call that a fugal section right there. Fugues are cool. That's all this, that's what's important.
Fugue's good. We like.
Fugue good, yes. More fugue. Much fugue.
I was thinking, you know, we all sort of think that we know this piece. Like, everybody's like, oh, yeah, Beethoven's Fifth. I know that one. I don't know classical music, but I know Beethoven's Fifth. And, but as I'm listening to this third movement, I'm like, I've never heard this before.
Right. Right. And why would you? And it's, here's another really good reason why. It's almost impossible to extract that movement, because Beethoven does something else incredibly unique, in that he segues the third and fourth movement together. So the third movement doesn't really have an end. Uh-huh. So unlike a piece like, well, even Beethoven's Third or Beethoven's Fourth or Sixth or Seventh, you can play all those movements as single movements. They're self-contained. Even if they relate to what comes before and after them, they still have a beginning and an end. Mm-hmm. But the third movement of Beethoven's Fifth does not have an end. So you wouldn't just like randomly hear some classical announcer be like, and now we're going to hear the third movement of Beethoven's Fifth. Uh-huh. Because there's no end. So
you can't
it goes straight into the fourth. Yeah. Huh. So, yeah.
Wow. And is that how he notated it? Is that sort of known? Okay. He was like.
Yeah. Because when you hear the end of the third movement, it gets really kind of quiet, and he does this kind of, it's like a dominant pedal is what I would call it, where he sits on this one note that, because of music we've heard all our lives, leads us to believe that something else is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gives us that sense that, oh, something else is coming, and then it builds and builds. Here, it's happening right now.
Okay.
So this is the end of the third. Yep.
So are we in the fourth movement now?
Yep.
Whoa.
So that's the beginning of the fourth movement. Quite a change of mood, too, over the first movement, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, much happier, lighter, maybe militaristic, triumphant is the word a lot of people use, from tragedy to triumph.
Uh-huh.
The Fifth Symphony travels, so,
That's great.
And to me, when I heard this when I was a kid, I was like, God, this sounds like movie music to me.
I thought the same thing. In fact, I was just about to say, what that transition reminds me of is, I don't know if you're a Hitchcock fan, but in his movie Rope, and he actually used this tool in a few of his movies, but that whole film is done in one room, one camera shot that just flows, and he'll use, he never cuts from scene to scene, but he'll pan the camera across somebody's back, say, to cut to the next scene. And I was like, oh my God, Beethoven is Hitchcock. He's Hitchcocking right now. Brilliant.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. This is also, in the fourth movement, the first time you'll ever hear a piccolo in any of Beethoven's music, as well as trombones. He put trombones in here, which was new for him, not new for the world, but new for him. Same with the piccolo, not new for the world, but it was the first time he used it, and contrabassoon. So he threw in a couple extra instruments that he'd never scored for, which is pretty cool. And oh, the piccolo, you can hear it like almost all the time throughout the whole movement. It's just spectacular.
I'm going to listen for it.
Yeah, I can point it out. It'll be coming up here in just a sec. You should be able to hear it now.
Okay.
Hear it way up there?
Yeah.
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 It's so cute. I just always imagine, and I'm sure none of them are accurate at all, but I always imagine these things in my head, like Beethoven sitting at the piano, like scratching out, because he always scratched stuff out, like, oh, no flute. Piccolo, let's do piccolo. You know, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, that thing that you just said about him scratching stuff out reminded me of this quote by Leonard Bernstein, where he kind of addresses the imperfections of Beethoven's work and his struggles. Let's give it a listen. I want to hear what you have to say about it.
Okay, sure.
There is no aspect of Beethoven in which you can say Beethoven is great as a melodist, a harmonist, a contrapuntist, a tone painter, his orchestration. You can find fault with all of them. If you take any one of these elements separately, you find nobody. There's nothing there.
Well, what makes it interesting?
Well, it's the form. A case of what note succeeds every other note. And in Beethoven's case, it is always the right next note, as though he had some private telephone wire to heaven, which told him what the next note had to be. No composer ever had that, even Mozart, to that degree, where everything is so unpredictable and yet so right. It all checks. It all works out. You can rely on it. You know the next note has to be the next note and the only next note that could come. And that makes his form perfect. If you look at those sketches, you see the crossings out, you see the agonies that this man went through. And what has finally appeared as the finished product looks as though it was simply phoned in from God. That's what's so incredible.
I think that's fair to say. And I think, you know, that feeds into what I was saying earlier, how that he really can carry a tune and you know, write a melody, but so much of his very famous music is very episodic and motivic like this, you know. It's like built from a seed, and from that seed the piece of music grows. So yeah, that's very typical with Beethoven for sure.
Nice. Well, I want to know how this piece influenced other composers. Like, where does it show up in the people who were, anywhere from Beethoven's contemporaries to, like, people, composers now? Like, where are you hearing it?
I think one of the things that Beethoven helped composers do is to stop being so concerned with all the rules all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, Mozart and Haydn had very, very specific ways they did things. And while they were innovators in their own ways, they just innovated in very different ways than Beethoven. And I think he allowed musicians at the time to feel really free from those constraints, even though there were still constraints. Mm-hmm. But he kind of stretched the boundaries of everything he touched musically. And that gave all the composers who came after him, like, you hear Beethoven in Schubert a lot. You can hear, like, sometimes if I hear an orchestral passage I'm not familiar with, sometimes I'll think, that sounds like Beethoven, but the harmonies are wrong, so it's got to be Schubert. things like that, you know?
Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, the cyclic symphonies, how, you know, that's spawned a whole set of pieces from various people like Brahms and Dvorak, and even Liszt. Franz Liszt wrote a lot of cyclic works. Yeah, his stamp is on just about everyone. And of course, Brahms is the one. And Brahms came after Beethoven died. And Brahms was just like so horribly intimidated by what Beethoven had done with the symphony that it took Brahms like 20 some years to write his very first symphony. So wow. Not only do you hear the influence musically, but you can see the influence psychologically as well. Uh-huh. That's that whole, it's called the anxiety of influence. You know, writers, other artists, they all deal with this. You know, well, geez, you know, Picasso was so great. What could I possibly add to the world? And that's right. Kind of, I think, what Brahms felt. And
like Brahms could have just sat there and written lullabies forever.
Exactly.
Because he was so intimidated.
Exactly. And he almost did. And then when his first symphony premiered, they called it Beethoven's 10th, which was very mean.
Oh my God, that's just rude.
Yep. Yeah, because there are a lot of similarities between it and Beethoven's 9th. And yeah, I mean, oh, that poor guy.
Man,
poor Brahms.
That's
another one we could talk about all day.
Seriously rough.
Yeah.
Pour
yeah,
your
he
heart
had
and
it
soul
rough.
Into something and then yep. just to have people call it derivative. Oof.
Yep. Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah.
What is to you the most surprising thing about this piece that maybe we don't know? I mean, the whole reason we're talking about this is because we all think that we know this piece, and clearly, you know, I think that we've proven that we don't. So, but what's the most surprising thing?
I think one of the things, and I remember this from when I was a kid, because when I first heard the whole symphony, I knew the first movement. I was familiar with it. And the second, third, and fourth movements were completely foreign to me. And I fell in love with them almost more than the first movement as a result, because it's almost like that fate knocking on the door, if you will, is mm-hmm. overshadows the greatness that comes after it, because we're so hung up on how bizarre that is to start a symphony with four notes and use those that four-note motive for the next 8 minutes is just... Nobody had done that before. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think we really get hung up on that and forget about how that carries through the full piece of music and just how, I guess, invigorating it is to hear those elements come back and twist around each other and stuff. So,
yeah, so basically the most surprising thing is the rest of the symphony.
Yes. Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Emily Rees, this has been so much fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
I feel like
Misha,
we should go get a drink now. Are you?
Yeah, I know.
Are you free? Let's go.
I'd rather come down there. That's for sure. Than
yeah, get warm.
Invite you up here.
Bring your shorts. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm glad we were finally able to connect. And
me too.
It's been great.
Me too.
All right.
Thank you so much, Daisha.
Sure, thanks. All right, everybody, that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classical Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. There are links to our social media and all of the many, many ways that you can listen to us. Make sure to rate and review us however you listen, and to never wheat paste our logo throughout your city, because that would be wrong. So wrong. You can email your burning questions to me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks today to audio producer Todd the Tower Holslander for making us sound nice. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for being an example for young people everywhere. No, we mean it. Thanks to Emily Rees for being on the show all the way from Minnesota. Thanks to me for saying words. But mostly, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.